Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
In the last several hours, Russia has invaded Ukraine.
Ukraine has been attacked from the north, the east, and the south.
Putin is the aggressor. Putin chose this war.
A country under attack after a huge Russian military offensive by land, sea, and air.
Within moments, missile strikes began to fall on historic cities across Ukraine.
On February the 24th, 2022, President Vladimir Putin of Russia ordered his troops into Ukraine. I watched in disbelief as Russian soldiers came over the border into my home country in tanks and armed vehicles.
They are now moving on Mariupol. Quite possibly in the next 24 hours or so, we could see Mariupol surrounded.
In weeks, the strategic port city of Mariupol became the most heavily bombed and damaged city in Ukraine.
Mariupol, burning. Apartment blocks in ruins after 2 weeks of unrelenting Russian bombardments.
90% of our infrastructure has already been destroyed.
The city's authorities say that civilian deaths have risen above 2,100.
As Russian troops advanced, many civilians fled towards the fort. Was a place of safety, a steel plant with underground shelters on the outskirts of the city, Azovstal. But within days, they would be trapped. I am Diana Kurishko, and for the BBC World Service, this is the documentary. The story of the siege of Azovstal, told by the people who survived it.
I know that a lot of people really thought that a big bloody war was about to start, but somehow I didn't think about it. In those last days before the beginning of the Russian invasion, it had been warm outside. Andrei and I lived in a private house, and even though it was still winter, tulips had begun to bloom in our garden. I can say that I finally started to feel really happy. Happier than in my whole life, because I met a man who I loved, and because I had the opportunity to write poetry.
In 2022, Valeria Subotina was working as a poet. But years earlier, she joined the Azov Brigade, part of Ukraine's National Guard.
I had been a civilian for a year before the war started. I finally started to enjoy life and to believe in something good and beautiful. At that time, Andriy was an active soldier stationed in Mariupol. A couple of days before the invasion, he came home in the evening and said he was very worried and asked me to pack a bag and leave Mariupol. I told him that if war broke out, I would return to the army, to my native Azov regiment, in which I had served as a volunteer since 2015. I would stay in Mariupol and I would defend my city next to my comrades. You see, I feel like a part of this city. I was born in it. I would not leave it.
My name is Natalia Babeush. I'm 37 years old. I'm from Mariupol. Before all this happened, I used to work for the Azovstal steel plant as a high-pressure boiler operator. I loved my job.
Hello. For decades, the Soviet-era Azovstal steelworks has provided work for the people of Mariupol in East Ukraine. For the past few weeks, this sprawling four-square-mile complex has instead provided them relative shelter.
We decided to leave for Azovstal because we could already see city fighting happening out of the window of our home. We were being airbombed and shelled from ships at sea.
Deep beneath the Azovstal steel plant were over 30 bomb shelters. Desperate, people rushed to seek sanctuary there.
Within half an hour of arrival, the electricity transformer was hit. That left us with no light at all. We lived in total darkness for the next 2 months and 4 days. It all felt like one long day because all the days were alike. Each day was the same as the other. Always the same people, no privacy, and permanent darkness.
Ukrainian troops were also retreating to the plant. The factory was the only place left from which to hold the city's defense.
The last bastion of Ukraine's resistance is the Azovstal steel plant, perhaps a few thousand soldiers and civilians in its bunkers and tunnels, a patch of land holding out against one of the world's biggest armies.
Among the soldiers was Valeria, the poet.
2 days after the war began, I joined the Azov regiment, and we drove right up to the giant mouth of the Azovstal steel plant. We were going straight into its heart, into its core, the huge steel plant with iron hanging above our heads.
Azovstal had become the last bastion of Ukrainian military resistance, and with it, a target for Russian shelling.
Imagine a building with 4 floors, tanks fire at close range, ships fire artillery from the sea, and floor by floor, this building is being destroyed, 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 and in some places it is simply leveled to the ground. But below ground, there are stairs that lead you to underground tunnels and a maze of bunkers. Some are on -2, others on -4. Large concrete columns support the ceiling. But those columns, they were just like paper houses being blown away by shock waves. They fell directly on people. And in the middle of all this, we were trying to establish our strange life. Like mice, we would pull together what we could find. Some clothes, some rags on which to sleep. In some places, it was completely dark. Your eyes get used to it, and you think that you are starting to live like normally. But this is, of course, a completely abnormal life.
It wasn't long before Valeria was joined at Azovstal by her partner Andriy.
Andriy was wounded when he was fighting to protect Mariupol, and he too was eventually sent to Azovstal steel plant. His job was to help families and children who were also in the catacombs of Azovstal by bringing them food.
Along with many other families, Oleg Antropov was in the bunker with 9 of his relatives, including his 15-year-old son Oleg and 6-year-old daughter Dasha.
The children mostly drew. They more or less calmed each other down. They played and drew by candlelight or with LED flashlights. It was hard. We were always looking for something to feed the children.
But despite the awful conditions, there were small moments of lightness.
My son turned 16 in the bunker. We celebrated birthdays and everything that happened during those days. There was a woman there. She cooked food and made surprises for the children. Cakes and celebrations.
And as it happens, the woman who made the cakes was Natalia Babeusz.
My way of coping was to take care of others. It was that helped me emotionally and kept me going. The conditions were horrible. It was so dirty. I was always worrying about food poisoning, especially when it came to the children. Every morning, I would wake up and listen for shelling. If it felt safe enough, I would carefully creep up the stairs and out of the shelter. I'd take buckets and jars with me to collect water in case it rained that day. That was our water supply. Rainwater. Sometimes we also melted snow. I'll never forget the 8th of March. It snowed that day. We rolled big snowballs and placed them into buckets. It was with that water that we made our morning tea.
The families ate only once a day, at lunchtime. People slept to forget their hunger.
I did the cooking in the workshop above the shelter. It was a real cooking challenge. All the plaster from the ceiling would end up crumbling into my cooking. My priority was to save food from debris by covering either the pot or the pan. My own safety came second. It made no sense to run away because you didn't know where a bomb would drop. I started cooking at noon because there wasn't usually much shelling around that time, and by 2 p.m. lunch would be served. We made soup every day, which was just a tin of something diluted in water and boiled up. The children in the shelter began to call me Aunt Soup.
As hunger set in, the children at the plant drew pictures of the food they wanted Aunt Soup to cook. Pizza, French fries, cakes.
There was a boy called Artyom who drew a picture of pizza and placed it above my bed. I came down to my bed one night and I found this pizza drawing. Are you hungry? I asked. Yes, he said. I really want a pizza. It had me thinking for a long time. For about a week, I was trying to work out how I could make pizza. In the end, I asked the guys to bring me some flour. When they did, I used that flour to make flatbread and stashed it away. A few days later, we were giving some stewing meat. I fried it up, melted that fat off and put the meat on the top of the flatbread. I found a tin of sweet corn and added that on top. That was our pizza.
But despite putting on a brave face for the children, Natalia was losing hope of ever getting out.
We had no idea what was going on outside of the plant at all. It was total despair. A total absence of information. You don't know whether your nearest and dearest are alive. You don't know whether any part of Ukraine still exists. You don't know the slightest thing about what's going on in the world.
When a person is in an enclosed space and there is no food or water and children need to be fed, sometimes people there could quarrel and fight. It was hard. There was a day when I did nothing but sleep, but then I got myself in order. I coped for the sake of the children. I thought only about them. There was simply no other option. They dropped aerial bombs on us. Everyone got into a panic. We calmed each other down, but there were strikes all the time. They were bombing us from all sides. We thought that we wouldn't survive.
Meanwhile, in a different part of the plant, Valeria was also struggling.
On April 15th, the enemy dropped a very large aerial bomb on the command post. It destroyed our underground bunker. I was found among the dead bodies, the only one who was alive. On the one hand, a miracle, but on the other, a terrible tragedy.
It's the longest siege of the war. Bombed for weeks, the Azovstal steel plant in Mariupol has been a priority target for Russia as it takes aim at the Azov battalion holding out there.
I had to spend 8 days in our field hospital in the plant with severe concussion. It was a very scary place where our wounded comrades with amputated limbs were lying absolutely everywhere. They couldn't get a proper help because there was very little medicine. The smell of blood and rot was everywhere. A comrade called Alexander, who had lost his arm 4 days before, used his other hand to feed me soup with a spoon so that I could somehow get better. My Andrew and I always planned to get married. We wanted to do it in the Ukrainian church in Mariupol. But now, after my injury, Andrew started talking about how it would be nice to marry right there, in the Azovstal steel plant. He made wedding rings out of tin foil and asked me to marry him. I, of course, said yes. He promised me that we would have a proper wedding when we could return home. So that's how we got married, on May 5th, in the Azovstal steel plant.
That was the 5th of May. A day later, there was more news. The civilians at the plant were to be evacuated.
It was the 6th of May, at about 4 or 5 p.m. The soldiers came over and told us we had 15 minutes to pack because we were about to be evacuated.
We've been told that there was an agreement about our exit. But to be honest, we didn't think they would reach an agreement at all.
It was totally unexpected. I had been trying to cook all day, but there had been constant shelling, so there had been no lunch that day. When the soldiers came over and said, "Get ready and let's go," I dropped everything and followed them. I couldn't believe it. I honestly thought we were never going to be released from there.
Daylight, at last. After weeks in a maze of underground tunnels, it's thought around 1,000 civilians have been hiding beneath the Azovstal steel plant in Mariupol, sheltering from Russian bombardment. Supplies had been cut off. Conditions were desperate.
We walked in small groups accompanied by our soldiers onto the plant site. Then we saw UN and Red Cross waiting to meet us and guide us to the buses that would take us to questioning by the Russians. Our belongings were checked. Even shoe insoles were checked, lifted to see what was underneath. They took our fingerprints and photographs in profile. We were interrogated for hours. They wanted to hear whether we had anything to do with the military.
Civilians had fled on the 6th of May, but Valeria, along with other Ukrainian troops, stayed to defend Azovstal.
You know how they often say that people feel something when a person they love dies? I did not feel anything like that on May 7th. On the contrary, I was in a good mood because I was married, I was in love. And on May 7th, I remember how the other girls there and I really wanted to see the tulips. Everything was destroyed, but the tulips were still standing. Somehow they blossomed all over Azovstal. They were like proud soldiers with red hats scattered across the plant, as if they weren't afraid of the enemy and somehow continued to support and make us happy. And I really wanted to have a look at them that day.
Andriy and Valeria were both at Azovstal, but Andriy was stationed in a different part of the plant to Valeria.
And from the 7th to the 9th, I continued to send letters to my husband through the border guards. Many of them already knew, but they pretended that everything was fine.
The situation was getting desperate for the fighters of Azovstal. On May the 10th, Lieutenant Ilya Samoylenko of Azov Brigade spoke to Sky News live from Azovstal steel plant.
Nobody has been expecting for us to hold against the Russians for so long, but still we're fighting. We're taking heavy casualties, we're taking losses, people are dying right now. Our lives means nothing, but our fight means everything.
On the night of the 10th, a comrade called Kalina came to me, and I understood everything in that moment, just from the expression in his face. He said that my husband had died, but we will bury him with dignity. I then interrupted him and said, "Why are you talking about what we will not do?" I knew that the bodies would stay in the plant. But he said the negotiations were going on and the bodies would be handed back. I think he really believed that. But my husband's body still remains there now, on the territory of Azovstal plant.
All eyes have been on the Azovstal steelworks, where the last remaining Ukrainian fighters in Mariupol have been holed up for weeks. Now, new satellite imagery shows the extent of Russia's relentless air and ground bombardment of the plant to get those fighters out.
Right now, when the circle is tightening, we need immediate extraction or evacuation. We received incredible united support from the world, from the people of the free world that we are defending right now, and from the Ukrainian people. But warm words, any words of support, will not stop the bomb from collapsing your bunker. That may happen like in the next couple of minutes, or maybe 1 hour, or maybe tomorrow, or nobody knows.
Meanwhile, Natalia and other civilians were heading to Ukrainian-held territory.
No words can describe how I felt as I got off the bus in Zaporizhia.
Це неймовірне відчуття, коли ти хочеш цілувати землю.
It is an incredible feeling. You want to kiss the ground. The moment we got off the coach, I finally felt safe. Now it was all over. Thank God. It means it happened for a reason. I had survived in order to be able to help other people.
It's been a brutal and bloody 83 days, but their battle is over, for now. The wounded from Azovstal are carried out of the vast steel plant.
On May 16th, our commander came to see us. He said that according to the president's order, we have to evacuate Azovstal and surrender to the enemy. We cannot fight to the end because we must protect our wounded. What did I feel? I felt that I really didn't want that because those people had killed my husband. I did not trust them at all.
Tired and wounded, Moscow released these images of Ukrainian fighters leaving the steelworks they'd been defending in Mariupol, giving themselves up to the Russians.
It was so strange. Just standing on the surface, under the sky, beside these layers of destroyed factory. We moved to the exit of the factory, and the Russians were there waiting for us.
When they surrendered, there were hopes they might be part of some sort of prisoner exchange.
but that now seems a dwindling hope.
We were driven away through the ruined town of Mariupol. We stared through the windows of the bus at all the ruins, at those buildings we loved, at those streets that we knew so well. They had put their flag on our crumbling buildings.
It's reported that 1,000 of them have been sent to Russia for investigations.
This feeling of losing my Andriy, of losing my city, my friends, I felt nothing mattered anymore. All my dreams died with my husband. That's probably why the Russians had a hard time interrogating me. Because they didn't know how to scare me. There was simply no fear left. It was impossible to break me.
Mariupol and the Azovstal steel plant remain under Russian occupation. Natalia now lives in Lviv, in the west of Ukraine, and works as a boiler operator there. Oleg and his wife and children have moved to the Czech Republic. Valeria survived 11 months as a prisoner of war and has traveled to Geneva to speak out against the torture she suffered. An estimated 900 Azov Brigade soldiers who fought at Azovstal remain in Russian captivity. The Azovstal ruins stand as a monument to the Ukrainian people's heroic resistance. You've been listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service. The presenter was me, Diana Kurishko. The actors were Valeria Pogolsha and Sasha Sezonenko. The producer was Sarah Shebie.
The information spaces we inhabit can resemble a hall of mirrors.
It's called guided democracy or managed democracy. There are different parties, different candidates, but everyone knows who is going to win.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast helping you make sense of them.
We've seen a crackdown on the opposition. We've seen an increase in censorship.
That's The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.